Welcome. I'm Sandhya Dirks, filling in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In October, former Vice editor Charles Davis released emails he'd received from higher-ups expressing concern over an article critical of the National Football League. The people upstairs weren't happy with the post and required that any future stories related to brands with whom Vice might someday do business, such as the NFL, needed to get prior approval. That's one of the more blatant examples of brands having influence over editorial decisions, but it isn't out of step in today's digital journalism world. Corporations are trying to establish news outlets related to their business, and there's been a rise of native advertising, which is basically paid for corporate-created content that shows up in the midst of news sites as if it were just an editorial. Native advertising doesn't seem as strange coming from new web media sites like BuzzFeed, who has built their entire business model around branded content. But it's no longer the domain of digital natives, and sponsored content is cropping up even in traditional news organizations such as the New York Times, Forbes, Time, The Atlantic, The Guardian, The Washington Post, and even public radio. Since launching their new ad strategy in January, the New York Times has struck deals with 32 different brands, from Netflix to Thomson Reuters, and even has a separated in-house content studio that writes content for advertisers. So there's writers writing for advertisers that are employed by the Times, advertisers like Dell. Since papers have moved online, they've been struggling to generate revenue and attract advertisers. But this new form of branded content comes with a lucrative revenue stream. For some media observers, the financial success and ubiquity of native advertising comes at a high cost, that of advertiser transparency. What might have been clear advertising in the past might now be disguised in the modern garb of content branding. So where should the line be drawn in the digital realm where all kinds of ad content is jumbled together? And how can readers, listeners, and viewers know the provenance of what they're reading and trust that it's news? Those are some of the very tricky questions we're going to be tackling today. Joining us will be Jackie Clement. She's the CEO and Executive Director of Fair Media Council. That's a nonprofit media watchdog organization that educates and advocates for quality local news coverage. She's worked in both the business and editorial sides of the newspaper industry. We're also joined by Joshua Benton, the director and founder of the Nieman Journalism Lab, part of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard. The lab seeks to help journalism adapt to the internet age and reports on digital media innovation. We're also joined by Mary Brown, the COO of Voice of San Diego, a local nonprofit news organization with a native advertising program. And we want you to be part of the conversation. If you've read papers like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal online, do you notice native advertisements? Maybe something that doesn't seem like it fits with the rest of the content? How does it impact your opinion? Does it change the way you feel about the outlet? Does it take away a sense of trust? How do you guarantee that the news you're reading is trustworthy? How critical are you of the media you consume? And how do you cultivate that awareness? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK or drop us an email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or better yet, post a web comment at yourcallradio.org. Welcome, guys.
Hello.
Hello. Hello there.
Hi. So I know that this is a really, really complicated topic with a lot of different things going on. And I'm wondering, what is, you know, for those of us who are just beginning to understand this concept of native advertising, it's relatively new, it's just beginning to get talked about. What does native advertising or brand journalism look like? How is it different from traditional advertising in newspapers, TV, and websites? Jackie, what's different about this?
Well, actually, it's interesting in the respect that there's nothing really new here. What's different is now it's entering the digital domain, basically. What we're talking about is basically a new twist on what old-school folks would call an advertorial. The basic setup with native advertising is this. You have people inside a newsroom now, usually, working with an advertiser to create a story.
Absolutely.
Basically cuts across the standard of that's what you wanted separated in the past to ensure the credibility and the trust.
And do you think that this sort of new way of doing things, this integration of advertising into storytelling in these outlets, is cause for concern? Is there a breaking down of the firewall between reporters who are trying to tell the truth and advertisers who are trying to sell their product?
Oh, absolutely. It's the world going to hell in a handbasket in one fell swoop right there. I am not a supporter of it at all. And it's not because I can't recognize it. I do know what it is, and I do see it plainly because it is marked. But I deal with the public at large, and we need to understand two things. One is the average American citizen receives no education in what news is. It's not taught how to recognize it from other forms of media. There's no standard in the K-12 education system in America. The other component of this that's really dangerous is, while there are guidelines for the news outlets to maintain some sort of integrity in doing this, there's no laws that ensure it. And you're really relying on the skill set and the integrity of the individuals that are involved in it. So there's no real standard.
Absolutely. Joshua, I wanted to turn to you really quickly and ask you, obviously this comes out of a longstanding issue, and that is how we fund journalism. During the digital age, funding journalism has become an even more complicated equation, where there used to be the classified ads in newspapers, and then that was usurped by Craigslist. People don't want to go behind a paywall. They want what they want, and they want it now. But journalism and journalists still have to be employed. It costs money to tell the kind of stories that really comprise hard-hitting investigative and enterprise journalism. So is this a natural response to needing to find a way to pay for it, or is there something else going on?
Well, I do want to clarify one thing that was just said. In the vast majority of cases, it's not people in newsrooms who are working on this content at all. As you said in the introduction at the New York Times, for example, they have a separate content studio, which is the same at all the other major traditional news organizations that are doing this. That means that there is someone who is on the business side, essentially someone who would have been selling an ad before, who is working on creating this content. And in that sense, it's really not that different from what existed before when in the age of print advertorials. News organizations always had a business side, an advertising side, and that side generally had people who would help create some of the ads if that was a service that the advertiser wanted. It was optional back then. It's optional now. Some companies will bring forward a specific piece of content that they have produced. The main reason why news organizations are doing this is in money. There's really no doubt about that. It is that advertising online has not been a sufficient replacement for all the money that has been lost from advertising in print or in broadcast or other media formats that news organizations are coming from. And the kinds of online advertising that make money are not the kinds of online advertising that news organizations are particularly good at. Google makes an awful lot of money in online advertising, but that's because they have a giant search engine that has a really good idea of what people are searching for and can put an ad for it right next to their search results. Facebook makes an awful lot of money in online advertising, but that's because they know an awful lot about you as an individual, what you're interested in, who your friends are, what are the new stories that you clicked on in the past. They have this enormous amount of data, which enables them to make a lot of money on online advertising. The difference is that news organizations, even the biggest and most digitally savvy, don't have anywhere near that kind of data. So they're stuck sort of selling generic ads that go to their entire audience without any sort of personalization. And they can make some money at that, but they can't make nearly enough to maintain the, you know, the size of the operation that they want. So the idea behind native advertising, for better or worse, is these organizations have a lot of skill at creating good content. They have a lot of knowledge of their audience, and they often have a very desirable audience. And the thinking is that if they work on creating this kind of ad that breaks outside of a rectangle that your eyes very easily go over, that they might be able to make some more money. And to be honest, it's working thus far. I think there's some questions about how sustainable it's going to be, but it's you know, like all advertising, it's a quest for money.
Absolutely, and you do need money to do these other things. Mary, I wanted to turn to you because Voice of San Diego is one of the few nonprofits experimenting with native advertising. In your case, the Partner Voices section, it's a separate section on the site. You don't display the sponsored content alongside editorial copy, and it's dedicated to telling the stories of local nonprofits as opposed to corporations. The sort of article-length partner promos, and they're either paid for by the nonprofits themselves or on their behalf by a corporate sponsor. I wanted to ask, how did Voice of San Diego go about building this native advertising program? And what ethical concerns did you guys talk about while you were doing it?
Oh, well, this is, you know, 10 years in the making. We grappled with all of the things that you're talking about today on the program, you know, how to maintain our integrity, how to make money and be sustainable, and where do the two intersections cross. The thing that we really found, you know, throughout our history was that we were never really comfortable as a nonprofit news organization with a mission of making our content as accessible to as many people and educating as many people as possible. We'd never really been comfortable with the whole traditional sense of advertising in general. We always encouraged anyone, any businesses or corporations who wanted to use our platform to get their message out, that they really focus that message on the good work they're doing in the community as opposed to, you know, selling a specific widget or product or service. So we had sort of established early on that if you want to use Voice of San Diego as a platform to get your message out, let's talk more about what you're doing to give back to the community and elevate your brand that way. So we had already sort of established that foundation with just our basic display, you know, banner ads. What we found out was that we started to have really a bigger client base of people and organizations who were more concerned about spreading the word about nonprofits. We're a nonprofit ourselves. We have a very engaged audience of people who want to give back to the community. So our number one client base really started becoming nonprofits who needed to do a better job of telling their story. So that was the evolution for us. How can we create a product or a vehicle for them to better tell their story? And how can we make money from it? And in the same process, how can we be very transparent to our community of readers and supporters about where this content is coming from, who it represents, and who's writing it? And so that's why we felt really strongly about creating a separate section, very clearly explaining and really almost over the top explaining that this content is paid for by the nonprofit or by a corporation who supports it. And I think we've gotten, you know, very little backlash, if any. I think we really go over the top about being transparent about it, and it's been a very favorable response from the community.
Okay, absolutely. And Jackie, I wanted to go back to you really quickly. Obviously, we need to, in this new brave new world of journalism, we need to find ways to fund reporting, to fund the reporters to do the work that brings us the content. But do you think that there's any, I know you had some very strong sentiments at the beginning, do you think that there's any kind of good native advertising, there's any good way in which to implement this new model for sponsored content?
Well, I think that answer is kind of complicated, so let me see if I can break it down. First, just going back to something Josh had mentioned. Is it okay if I say Josh, or do you prefer Joshua?
It's great.
Okay. you know, I had worked at Times Mirror back in the late 80s when Mark Willis was the chairman. Mark made headlines because what he tried to do was break down the wall between news and advertising and have the news reporter working side by side with the person in advertising to work on stories together. He thought it made sense community-wise, that it would build a stronger community. It didn't work then. So now we're going forward from, I'm going to say, between 96 and 99 was that time period. Now we're in 2014. So we're still kind of talking about the same issue. So to Josh's point, a lot of places are set up where they have separate departments working on this, where the advertorials would have come out traditionally. But a lot of newsrooms don't. A lot of newsrooms are working with diminished staff, so they're actually requiring the staff to do far more than they used to do, one of which is, oh, on the side, can you write this basically an advertorial? So the issue that really is at the heart of it, from my perspective, is inside a newsroom, you can think you are very clear in the labeling, in the branding, in the way you've set it up so that it looks different from a regular news story. But if it's not resonating with the public, if they're not able to distinguish the difference, you're failing.
I still kind of wanted to ask the question. Obviously, there are these diminished staffs. One of the reasons is because there isn't funding for not just newspapers, but all kinds of types of journalism, and people are really struggling to figure out how to do it. So then the question is, yes, we obviously need a firewall, ethically speaking, between advertising and journalistic content. But if not with these sponsored content, how are we going to find ways in which to bolster and sustain the journalism that we're trying to protect by creating these firewalls?
Are you back with me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. I didn't want to take up too much time there. We're looking at something that, how to sustain something that everyone's been struggling with now for quite some time. Do I know the answer offhand as to how to do that? No. If I did, I'd be rich. But it does come down to whether or not you want to be a credible news organization or whether you want to be something known for branded content. Whether or not you want to be more entertainment and more advertising. So that's a philosophical decision to be made within a brand. Now, brands do have actual news happenings within them where they can be covered by the news side for valid news stories. This kind of gets in the way and mucks it up. But if you're looking in terms of basic revenue, you know, originally when newspapers went online, the intention was not that you put all of the content online. It was meant to be a teaser that would drive you to go buy the print product. But then somewhere along the way, someone decided, let's put the whole product up there. And then they realized they were giving away their content for free. Then they tried to do the firewall where you have to buy the subscription.
Yeah, the
which
paywall.
Which hasn't gone
yeah.
over so well. Yeah. You know, I know some places they are starting to see revenue generated out of that. But that, again, is a different mentality that people aren't used to. You know, go back to when bottled water was introduced. Nobody wanted to buy it.
Absolutely.
But now it's norm.
Absolutely. And I wanted to go back to Mary with Voice of San Diego, because I know that it's a really innovative news platform. There is no paper, no brick-and-mortar version of it. It is just online. And you guys are very kind of local coverage of San Diego. And in a lot of ways, you kind of helped pioneer this new movement of local nonprofits that do really focused reporting. But obviously, you know, dealing with funding, finding new ways to support what you guys do is an imperative part of producing the kind of journalism that VOSD does. So do you think that Voice of San Diego is getting something out of the specific way you do the sponsored content with nonprofits? And do you think that the platform will be sustainable as you guys go forward?
I do. I mean, I want to say that, you know, we feel very comfortable with the way this is working out. We do not feel like it's compromising our integrity. We do feel like it's something that we should actually be proud of. We're helping local nonprofits tell their stories, and we're helping connect people with volunteer opportunities and things that they can do in the community to give back. Now, if it turned out that one of those nonprofits found themselves, you know, in the midst of a scandal, I mean, we would also investigate that nonprofit and write a hard-nosed news story about it. So, you know, I don't feel like one trumps the other in any way. And the in fact, when we, you know, enter into a relationship with a nonprofit or any advertiser for that matter, we say, you know, there are no sacred cows here, and you could very well find yourself at the other end of an investigation, and just know that going in. And we may lose some advertisers as a result of that, or some nonprofits might not want to do things with us as a result of us knowing more about them than they might want us to. So I think we have to be creative. I think we have to be innovative. I think we have to be aware of the concerns that Jackie's talking about, and we need to address them head on. And I do believe that you can educate your audience and bring them along with you on this journey. I think maybe we are underestimating what they're capable of.
And do you feel it's part of your job in a sense too? I mean, how obvious are you guys about the fact that this is sponsored content, that this isn't the normal kind of Voice of San Diego coverage?
Very. I mean, if you go to that section, there's a gigantic orange banner at the top that says this is sponsored content. I mean, we invite these nonprofits to come to our events. We do a lot of community engagement events. We invite them to come. We introduce them as this is one of our sponsors. You might have read one of their partner promos on our website. It's woven into everything we do. It's definitely not something that we try to keep secret. It's really easy to distinguish that content from our other stories.
And I think it really does come down to implementation. If the way that the New York Times does it, for example, the labeling is very clear. They use a different typeface, different headline appearance. It's if you read New York Times stories online and you see one of their sponsored stories, they will look different. And I think they manage the presentation of those stories within the site quite just fine. The teases to those stories appear in advertising slots as opposed to in news slots. They run as banners. That's what you click on to go to them. They don't have any connection with the New York Times newsroom. I think it's very possible to have these ads done in a way that is, you know, completely ethically strong. I think it's also completely possible to violate some very core values in journalism. But it's really up to each individual news organization about how they're going to manage it. And I think I would recommend evaluating it on that sort of case-by-case basis as opposed to saying that that it's, you know, a bad thing all around. Because there have been plenty of studies going back throughout the 20th century that a lot of readers of newspapers confused what was an ad and what was a story. That's always been an issue. Advertorials that ran in newspapers, newspapers that had good standards, would require that they would run in a different typeface. They would look a little bit different. They would have a wrapper around them that said advertorial or sponsored content or whatever it may be. It really comes down to how you implement it. I don't think there's anything, you know, inherently wrong with saying that instead of giving advertisers access to a rectangle so many pixels wide, we're going to give them access to a web page on our site.
And I think that this is a conversation that obviously there's still a lot to be said about how we pay for news, how we really create that ethical firewall between advertisement and journalistic content. And lots of newsrooms are grappling with this right now as we're talking about today. We're speaking with Jackie Clement, CEO and Executive Director of Fair Media Council, a nonprofit media watch organization that educates and advocates for quality local news coverage. We're also speaking with Joshua Benton. He's the director and founder of the Neiman Journalism Lab, which seeks to help journalism adapt to the internet age and reports on digital media innovation. And we've been speaking with Mary Brown from My Old Town of San Diego. She's the COO of Voice of San Diego, a nonprofit news organization with a native advertising program. And I wanted to, Mary, you'll be leaving us, but I wanted to thank you so much for joining us in this first half of the show and for talking about what Voice of San Diego does.
Thanks for having me.
Call us at 866-798-TALK or send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Sandhya Dirks, filling in for Rose Aguilar.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Again, the toll-free number to talk to us is 866-798-8255. Your call is made possible by KALW listeners and supporters, including Mona Brooks of San Francisco, Lexi Preto of San Francisco, Gregory Vos of Point Richmond, and David Four of Oakland.
If you're joining us, we're talking about the rise of native advertising and brand journalism. This is Your Call. I'm Sandhya Dirks, filling in for Rose Aguilar. Tomorrow, our Friday Media Roundtable, where we speak with journalists about coverage of this week's news. And coming up on Monday, we're speaking with Robert Okin, author of Silent Voices, a book about his work with homelessness, drug abuse, mental health, and life on the streets of San Francisco. And today, right now, we're talking about the growing influence brands have on reporting and the thin line between advertising and sponsored content and journalism and the question if will brand journalism and native advertising end the firewall between journalists and the corporations they cover, or is it a way to fund journalism in an increasingly spare age where it's hard to get the money to pay to make the content? We want to hear from you. What are your thoughts on this issue? Give us a call, 1-866-798-TALK. That's 1-866-798-8255. You can also email us, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Or go ahead, post a comment at yourcallradio.org. You can join our conversation by calling us 866-798-TALK or send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. We are joined this half hour by Jackie Clement. She's the CEO and executive director of Fair Media Council. That's a nonprofit media watch organization that educates and advocates for quality local news coverage. And we're also joined by Joshua Benton, the director and founder of the Neiman Journalism Lab, which seeks to help journalism adapt to the internet age and reports on digital media innovation. So before the break, we were talking about this incredibly sort of, you know, whether or not you can do sponsored content and maintain the firewall, and if it sort of is just a holdover from the way things have always been done. And Joshua, I wanted to ask you about outlets like BuzzFeed and Vice to a certain extent, where you have a certain part of their content is very much it's clickbait, whether or not it's candy. It's either sponsored by corporations or it's a test or it's something that they want you to click on. But they do that to increasingly fund more in-depth investigative journalism. They just announced a fellowship with Columbia Journalism School. Is this kind of new model of selling candy, in a sense, to be able to fund the spinach or the meat, is this something that we're seeing more and more of?
Well, there's an element which that's been true in the past. If you look, it's easy to think of what a newspaper looked like and only imagine, you know, the seven-part series that gets the mayor indicted. If you looked at a newspaper, even in the glory days, there's also a lot of area given over to the latest sports scores and the gardening column and the comics and a lot of ads and a whole lot of other stuff. So in a sense, the idea of creating a whole package where part of the content is popular and profitable and part of it is sort of riding along the economic benefits of the entire package, that's not that new. BuzzFeed's kind of an interesting case in that they actually don't have any other kinds of ads. They don't have banner ads in the classic sense. So all those stories where the viral hits of pictures of cats and lists of funny YouTube videos, they're not monetizing those directly. What they are doing is a sort of essentially proving to potential native advertisers that they know how to reach a big audience. They're sort of demonstrating that and essentially, you know, saying, hey, Google, hey, Dell, hey, you know, Company X, We're really good at creating content that gets a lot of attention online. We for the right amount of money, we can perform those services for you as well. I think that BuzzFeed is not as clear as they probably should be, to my mind, in making it visually clear what is sponsored content and what is not. I wish they would be a little bit stronger on that. But I do think that, you know, they're moving to hiring, you know, more more experienced reporters and doing more investigative work and hiring, you know, opening foreign operations and things like that. I do think it's part of wanting to create a whole package that people want to keep coming back to, and that's going to be a balance between the lighter stuff and the heavier stuff.
And Jackie, what do you think about that? Do you think that that kind of mirrors what we had in the golden age of newspapers, or is something more insidious going on in terms of using all of this sponsored content and these clickbait type stories or tests, as they may be?
Yeah, no, I'm actually very much in line with what Josh has been explaining, but I do think, though, the weakness in this whole equation is the public's inability to distinguish. And I keep going back to that because with native advertising and sponsored content, even if it's well-marked, well, newspaper columns are usually well-marked. The editorial is usually well-marked. The op-ed pieces are usually well-marked. But you know what? The bulk of my complaints about media and media bias that come from the public, and I work with a lot of nonprofits in the New York metro area as well as corporations of all sizes. When I look at their complaints and we sit down and we boil it down to what was the issue, what's the affront that the particular media outlet was committing, the reader, the watcher, the listener was most likely looking at a piece of biased material, and by biased material, I mean they were reading a column as opposed to a news story. They were reading an editorial. They were reading an op-ed. If those elements that are tried and true and have been around forever are still confusing the public, imagine how they're confused now with these new elements that we're throwing at them. And that's really where the weakness is in this whole setup.
So with that in mind, I want to call out to our listeners. Have you seen these ads in newspapers, online, on the New York Times, in different places? Have you seen these ads, and do you know what they are? Do you get confused? Have you been fooled by something you thought was journalism but was really an ad? Let us know. Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Saying talk again wouldn't help you guys. You can also send us an email at feedback@yourcall.org. And we have a call right now from Ed in San Francisco. He's calling about a Washington Post article that was by Uber that he felt posed as news. And we want to ask him how that changed his opinion of the Washington Post.
Well, Washington Post, as you know, as I'm sure you know, was bought by Jeff Bezos of Amazon.com. It was, I also read an article where you can click on links that'll give you to Amazon, but that's the secondary issue. Specifically, I was talking about Uber because I'm a cab driver, and I've got my prejudice, and I've been fighting them. And almost every article that appears to cover this organization is basically an advertising piece posing as news. Specifically, I want to take the Washington Post because I don't have the date of the article because I was in my car. It's about 6 months ago.
Did it bother you? Did it bother you? Did you think it was news at first?
Well, no, I don't think it was news, but everybody else did. I mean, KQED has actually done articles on Uber and Lyft that they thought were real good balanced articles, but were nothing of the kind. They were simply giving the advertising slogans that these people put out. But I've got a specific example in the Washington Post.
Okay,
They had an article about how people who drive for Uber were making like $90,000 a year or $70,000 a year if they were working for Uber. This is absolute bull because it was pointed out by other people that they have to buy the car, they have to buy the insurance, they have to do the mechanics, and so on and so forth.
Was that an article or was that sponsored content, Ed?
That's an article in the Washington Post by a newspaper reporter. I'll look it up. I've got a link. I'll send it.
So, I think with respect to that, I think you're probably making the sort of the confusion that we were talking about before, and that was a news article that was written. And I'm looking right now at a follow-up story that question those claims.
Hold on, let Joshua. I want to let Joshua finish here. What were you saying? You're looking at.
I would like to finish what I'm saying. The article that appeared in the Washington Post actually came from the Uber website, word for word.
Okay. All right. Well, Ed, thank you so much for raising these concerns with us. Joshua, finish what you were saying and talk to kind of concerns that there is this bleed over that people have between, you know, you do an ad for somebody one day and then you do an actual journalistic piece about them the next day. Maybe the journalism is good, but maybe people don't trust it.
Well, but that's something you could have said about any news organization that has ever run an ad. I mean, do you not trust any story that any newspaper ever wrote about a department store or a cell phone provider or a store at the mall? I mean, there is a basic issue that you can pick with the idea that advertising supports journalism, but it's not a new issue. It's an issue that's been around for a very long time. I think the caller is probably confusing an article that he found, disagreed with or found imbalanced in some sort of way with a piece of sponsored content. But, you know, I think this speaks to what we were just discussing about the need for, you know, better media literacy. It's a confusing world.
Yeah, no, and I think that that's really important because, I mean, whether we're talking about confusing, maybe it's not confusing the sponsored content for real journalism, maybe it's confusing journalism with the sponsored content because we just don't know what is what. And how do we do that? Jackie, I'm going to go to you. How do we increase media literacy so we know how to navigate, you know, the digital world where everything is out there and everything is together?
Well, I mean, it would be great if we can start with the children. I mean, what we know is between fourth and sixth grade is when children's critical thinking and deductive reasoning skills are forming. So it makes perfect sense to introduce them to news, to get them to understand the different elements contained within a news outlet's content, but also to teach them how important it is to compare and contrast news articles so that they're not only, you know, believing what they read in one article. Honestly, we've lost the ability to compare and contrast as media has more and more consolidated with mass media, which to my mind makes it even more important to try to start these exercises in the schools now that there's so much exploding online.
And Joshua, I think the same question to you. I know you do a lot of this about media literacy, about how to have journalism adapt to the internet age at the Nieman Journalism Lab. So what are some of the things you guys are doing to enhance media literacy and to help, you know, help people navigate, again, this world where everything is out there together?
Yeah, well, we don't work specifically in media literacy, but I will say that part of the issue here is that previously when you consumed a story, when you came across a story, whether that was in print or in broadcast or some other form, you were reaching it in a given context. If you saw a San Francisco Chronicle story, it was because you had picked up a copy of the San Francisco Chronicle.
Right.
And that meant you were able to sort of evaluate, is this on the front page? Is this something that's small and buried inside? Does it look different from all the stories around it and have the word advertorial at the top? You're able to make those sorts of evaluations. And knowing a bit more about the broader, you know, the brand, the news institution that you're consuming. It's a little bit different online, where every article from every website is essentially an atomized URL that you could reach through 1,000 different means. So if you're just clicking on something that you see on Facebook or something that you see on Twitter, that's a very different sort of information context that you're seeing it in. You may have noticed a couple months ago, Facebook was talking about putting a satire tag on stories linking to The Onion.
Exactly, because of all of those people who link to The Onion and they thought the stories were true and they write these outraged things. And
exactly, and you and I know what The Onion is, and I'm sure most of your listeners know what The Onion is and that they're a satirical news organization, but on any given Facebook wall, there's going to be someone who doesn't know that.
And now there's enough satirical news outlets where I still have very media-savvy friends who get fooled. At least, you know, once a week I have to write and I have to say, nah, that's not real.
Sure, absolutely. It's a much more, you know, dangerous environment to navigate because you have to understand what the cues are that are going to, you know, give you that sort of trust.
Do you think this is something that obviously, we are in a brave new world. As we get more familiar with these things, do you think that these are just things that will happen, they'll evolve in a certain way?
I do think anytime there is a new media format that it takes time for that to be ingested, essentially, and for people to understand how to deal with it. I think you saw that with the rise of blogging. I think you saw that with the rise of social media. In each case, it takes a little while to figure out what's going on. So I think part of it will help over time as new standards evolve, as new user behaviors evolve. But realistically, the old system was bounded by the fact that you had to own a printing press or a broadcast tower to reach people. Now you just need to have access to a computer and the internet, or your phone and the internet. So necessarily there are going to be many more people publishing than ever before, which is on net a wonderful thing, a glorious thing, but it does have the side effect of opening up people who either want to skew something for ideological reasons, or play pranks, or just want to anger a bunch of people.
Absolutely. And one thing I wanted to ask both of you guys was about yesterday, the news that Verizon sort of opened up its own personal content marketing venture. And this is sort of seems to be something a little bit new. It's called Sugar String. It's designed to offer articles on technology, culture, and politics. I think Best Buy also tried to create a similar news site. Joshua, what do you think about these sort of corporate news ventures?
Yeah. Well, what was announced yesterday was not the debut of that site. It was the closing of that site. It was announced some time ago and got the reaction you might imagine from people saying, I already give Verizon $100 a month. I don't want to get my tech journalism from them. One thing that is actually kind of interesting about native advertising, to bring it back to that, is how much of it is not about directly promoting the company that is paying for the content. It's about associating emotions or ideas with a company. One example of this would be GE, which is one of the giants in this space. That GE spends a huge amount of money on native advertisements at a wide variety of sites, and they have their own publishing ventures, their own websites that they either co-produce with the business side of a news organization or do on their own. But those stories are generally not about anything GE does. They are about innovation, and often very interesting, legitimate stories about innovation. And the reason is they want people to associate GE and innovation in their heads. The same way, the reason that you see all these IBM commercials about, building about smart cities and things. Part of that is just to change your association of what you think about IBM. It's really brand advertising in the classic advertising sense. And I think that you'll probably see some more efforts to create these sorts of outlets like as Verizon was doing, but they often don't need to create a news organization or a news site to do that. They have access to the web just like anybody else, and they're publishing their own information, and they're putting it out there, and again, it's up to the consumer to make sense of it.
Jackie, do you have thoughts on these sort of personal content marketing ventures that don't seem to be successful so far? Sugar String, they ended it yesterday. Best Buy didn't succeed. Corporate news ventures, do these worry you?
We do see more and more of that happening. I see a lot of it happening on healthcare websites in particular, as well as the financial industry. And their whole thought process on that, and Josh probably knows more about this in particular than I do, it was how do we just generate traffic to our website? And that's how they started coming up with the content. So in some cases, if I own a hospital, I'm putting up information on my website of tips on how to stay healthy during the holiday season or something along those lines, strictly because I just want people to come to my site so that I can say
the clickbait model,
traffic so I can sell some banner advertising.
Absolutely. In talking about these sort of Verizon Sugar String, the Best Buy one, these different sort of corporate news ventures. Obviously, right now, there's sort of equal access to the internet, the anarchy of the internet. And as you were saying, Joshua, that's a great thing. But there's also been a lot of talk recently about net neutrality. And I wonder if sort of changes about who has access to the internet might threaten, again, how we view and are able to be informed by what's journalism and what's advertising.
I mean, net neutrality is a significant threat, in part because you could imagine a world where if net neutrality were to go away and there were a fast lane and a slow lane on the internet, the companies that would be able to pay for access to the fast lane are unlikely to be news organizations because they're often having trouble just keeping the lights on. So you could imagine a world where technology companies would move into that space. And, there could be positive associations or results of that too, but I think the negative ones are pretty clear.
Absolutely. And I think it's an interesting net neutrality. And if that was to go away, the effect that would have on journalism is something I personally hadn't thought about before. We had a question from Anonymous in Antioch. I think it's very interesting. Anonymous writes, what are some of the worst case scenarios of how an advertiser could use sponsored content? And I wonder, do either of you have an example?
Well, one case that is probably the worst example that has happened from a news organization's perspective was a couple years ago. The Atlantic ran an ad for a piece of sponsored content from the Church of Scientology, and it was not well labeled. It did say sponsored content, but not in a very prominent way. The design of the story looked just like an Atlantic story, and it was very self-promotional. It was all about the glories of the Church of Scientology, and that doesn't line up particularly well with the views of the Atlantic's readership. So they got an enormous amount of pushback, and the Atlantic apologized and said they would not do that and changed a variety of ways of how they do it. That's notable because it's one of the few cases where the audience has really rebelled in any significant way. In most cases, these native advertising has happened at a lot of news organizations, and you know there haven't been protests in the street. There haven't been really significant audience reactions. I mean, you can imagine a scenario where a company would slander a competitor or try to plant lies into the national conversation. I think in general, if they're smart enough to be thinking we might want to take advantage of this opportunity, they're generally going to be smart enough to not abuse it in those sorts of cartoonish ways. But there's certainly room for some issues.
And Jackie, really quickly, can you think of a worst case scenario?
Oh, well, I remember back again, and this was a Times Mirror product. We're out in California. They did what we would call, I guess, branded content today, a story about the Staples Center, where the newsroom worked with the Staples Convention Center, uh-huh. I guess it is out there. But that was not disclosed to the readership, and people were fired for that.
So the it sounds in both of these examples, the kind of the worst case scenario is when there is no effort made to distinguish between what is advertising and what is journalism. And I want to go to a caller. We have Lee in San Francisco. Welcome, Lee.
Hi, thank you. I have to quibble with all due respect here. This discussion seems very naive to me, and whenever NPR or local stations, KQED, engages in these things, it seems like you're always pointing the finger outward. I listen to lots of shows on KQED where it's like a long promotion for the end of, like Marty Nemco's show. He's often going off on rants.
Just a note, we are KLW, not KQED. So just
okay, and even on KLW, I've listened to programs I think you have the Call a Lawyer night,
mm-hmm.
and it's basically a big promotion for the Bar Association where they try to get you to pay for consultations with lawyers, and it's like an hour long advertorial, and there are several programs like this that guide themselves as benefiting the community and mm-hmm. all of that kind of stuff when it's basically either outright advertising and self promotion to get you to act. Or it's branding. And, branding is as old as snake oil. And so everybody does it. And something as obvious and gratuitous as Scientology and Atlantic, of course people are going to get called on it. But NPR never gets called on their egregious and increasing amounts of advertising.
Well, actually, I think that's a great question. I'd love to put that to both Joshua and Jackie. Obviously, there is an increasing amount of underwriting on NPR. It's something that we hear more and more of. Is that a concern? Is the role of the old public radio model sort of being tarnished by increased underwriting in a world where we're all trying to figure out how to pay for journalism?
I if there's increased underwriting, I think that's a glorious thing because that means increased people working for public radio. I do think that the same sorts of the caller is correct to say that it raises the same sorts of questions, and it's up to each news organization how they're going to answer those questions. You know, to be frank, public radio has gone farther than that. I mean, the NPR accepts funding for reporting on specific subjects, where an individual foundation usually will say, I'm willing to give X hundreds of thousands of dollars to fund stories on topic X.
Their health care is funded by Kaiser, for example.
Sure, exactly. And, you know, again, if you can, you can evaluate those stories and see whether they are good, solid, you know, journalistically sound stories. And I think in most cases you would find that they are. But it's a question that is not something that came along just because the internet came along and BuzzFeed decided to start this. It's a question that has existed as long as there have been commercial news organizations
and apparently public
News
organizations too, dealing with some of the same things. And I think Lee is right to hold our feet to the fire. Jackie, I wanted you to weigh in.
Well, I'm in line with Josh on that one. The only thing I would add is, you know, the great thing about America is anyone can own a news outlet. The bad thing about America is anyone can own a news outlet. And that's the issue right there.
definitely flip sides of the coin. You know, the one other question I kind of wanted to ask was, we were talking about the firewall and the things happening on different floors, but I know that some companies are even hiring actual journalists for corporate media. The New York Times, in their new endeavor, has hired some former journalists to do sort of the story writing for companies like Chevron. And some make it into popular sections of news sites, like on Forbes. I wanted to ask what you guys think about this. Is it a problem if journalists go over to PR, or is that, again, something that's kind of as old as time?
Journalists have been getting substantial raises by moving over to public relations as long as the field has existed. I do think that there is this one difference, though, and that is that the model used to be you would start out at a news organization, and then you'd realize that you have a mortgage and want to make a good living, and then you'd switch over to PR. Now, because the work being done here is often on a case by case, you know, a story by story basis, you sometimes will have people who are doing stories for traditional outlets and doing stories that are sponsored content that gets run in traditional outlets but under a corporation's banner. They might be doing the same thing at the same time. You know, I'm not one to say that doing one story for a nonprofit or a corporation once means that you should be forever banned from writing for the public. I think that's a bit extreme. But it is a legitimate question that didn't exist in the same way before.
And then we have one last call. I want to make sure we squeeze in GS from San Leandro. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I appreciate this show very, very much. I'm an educator. Both my parents were. I think the most important thing is that we look long-term toward establishing and funding a full course, of like a semester course for people in the appropriate age group that was mentioned, where all of the terminology is brought to the fore. Everybody learns what is the difference between journalism and advertising.
GS, I'm going to have to cut you off. We're out of time, but media literacy, maybe we need more of it. You can join our thank you so much for joining us today. Thank you, GS. Sorry to cut you off. Thanks for all your calls and emails. I'm Sandhya Dirks, filling in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call.
On the Next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll talk about news coverage of protest from Ferguson to New York, from Egypt to Hong Kong. Why do journalists fall in love with some popular movements and turn against others? We'll be joined by Jadalia's Adil Iskander in Cairo, longtime China reporter Mary Kay Magstad, and Miami Herald columnist Leonard Pitts. Join us on the Next Your Call with Matt Martin and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.